Top of the morning to you. Good day, eh?
Good day, and welcome to another Forge Side Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between, with a heavy focus on talent in the Great White North. We're talking about Canada today, and I'm doing this one solo again, but I'm sitting down with Mark Pierce. Super pumped to sit down with Mark because, well, Mark was part of the catalyst of Forge Side Chat. We sat down with Mark back in, oh, what was that, 2019 or was it 2020?
2020, I think, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Mate, or was it even 2021? I've got my years so mixed up now at this point, but it was Can Iron Virtual Edition.
Can Iron 21,
yeah. Yes, there we go. Thank you. Man, wow. Time just flies, dude. I can't believe it. It's been a while. Mm. How you been, dude? Thanks for sitting down with me.
Yeah, no problem at all, Lando. Thanks for reaching out. Yeah, life has been good. It's no complaints at all in the blacksmithing business. As you know, Calvary's been really good to us over the years. And I think this year is our 28th year in business. And yeah, we're still going strong and no complaints whatsoever.
Beautiful. So if you want to get a little bit of a more of an insight on Mark, you can head over to canadairon.ca and use the code BIGANVILS to access the Canadian the Can Iron Virtual Edition. There's a 2-hour video of us chatting with, of myself chatting with Mark, actually. So there might be a little bit of repeat information that happens in here, but let me give you a quick rundown on Mark. He started off life in the early ages of the workforce doing something a little unordinary to the most, not something too many people are even familiar with. Lo and behold, masturbating turkeys is a thing. And Mark was a specialist. And he quickly realized that he did not want to continue that route in life for the rest of his life. Got into agricultural engineering, which led into blacksmithing with Rodney Cranwell in the Norfolk area. Continued after that, after a 5-year stint doing that, into welding and working for other blacksmiths. And at the same time, was also playing rugby. Got very professional with it. Was offered a sponsorship for university football in Nova Scotia, of all places. But that's not where he ended up keeping his Canadian residency. You know, he went on to play with the World League Football in Barcelona. Was then drafted by the Calgary Stampeders in 93. And if I'm not mistaken, you were drafted as number 99, were you not?
Yeah, that's correct, Lando. Yep. The general manager at the time, Wally Buono, picked me up in, actually it was the first round draft pick for Calgary. And that afternoon after the draft, I went to the stadium and they gave me the jersey with the number 99 on.
Did he mention anything to you about how number 99 holds a strong presence in the Alberta mines? No?
No whatsoever. And being a Brit coming over the pond and everything and only playing 1 year of university, I never was really exposed to your hockey religion here, so I had no clue who number 99 was at the time. And when the equipment manager gave me the jersey 99, I sort of like kicked up a bit of a fuss because you always want a number that makes you look bigger, like 78 or, you know, like a 79 or something. But the 99 was, it doesn't make you look too big. But I played 99 for that year. And then I left the Stampeders that year, went down south, but obviously got cut, came back up. And then they gave me 95. So I finished my career off as a number 95.
Well, I like to think is you as being one of the great ones in our community, man. So I think 99 was very fitting to you. And I'm happy to bring you on as number 90, episode 99 to Forge Side Chat in conjunction with that, man. I purposely played that out. I was like, 99, Mark Pierce, awesome. This will be great. The great one.
Well, maybe not. Not quite sure about that. There's many, many great ones out there, as we know, right?
Oh, dude, when it comes to your forge work, though, those staircases you do that are going into these exquisite homes, my dear Lord, man, I don't know. Like, how does one grow into doing such large scale work like that?
I think a lot of it comes down to, when I first started out in Calgary, it was obviously just my work ethic. I was playing football at the time, so I'm 5 hours a day at the stadium, playing training football and working out, and then I headed to my blacksmith shop to do another 5 hours of blacksmithing. So I was doing this day in, day out, knowing that there is potential for the blacksmith business and the blacksmith community up here in Canada, in Calgary. So yeah, I just kept plugging away and was doing it all. I was, you know, rewarded with the hard work, the long hours, and then the work just started coming in. You know, day after day, it was builders coming in with bigger projects. But then you're faced with other difficulties, right? Your labor, your skill set, your machinery, and, you know, all them had to be taken into consideration as Mystic Forge grew throughout the years.
What? Well, okay, so two things to that. Number one, this is a very familiar concept that's been coming up over and over again with Forgeside Chat, is putting in the work, the dedication, the discipline. That it all comes down to discipline when it comes to business. If you've got the ability to discipline yourself, to focus on your work, you will be successful in business. It's one of the key elements, and it's become very relevant to the blacksmithing world, that is one of the number one things you have to do as a maker. I don't know, do you look at yourself as being a maker necessarily, being on such a large scale that you do, or what's your view on that?
I think that I never got caught up in the me, this is my work, this is how I do it. I catered to the client, and I found a marriage between what they wanted and what I can do. So I know I can forge weld, I know I can pin and rivet and clip and all that stuff, but the client didn't want to pay for that. So you have to meet them halfway. And that's where, when you meet them halfway, you get to do most of what you want to do anyway.
Right.
You know, yep. So, and that's what we would do. We would entertain the client at the shop. We would make samples, and we would fine tweak the samples on site with the architect, designer, and everybody. And again, in my mind was, you have to find a marriage between the two of us. It's not all you and it's not all me, right?
Right.
And I know a lot of metal workers and blacksmiths that have gone bull in a china shop. This is what I can do. This is the way we should do it. And, you know, years down the road, you never hear of them again. So I think you have to really respect, one, the client who is paying you the money of what they really, really want. And 9 times out of 10, if you're working in one of these houses where the staircase is 6 figures, they are building their dream home. And you have to live that dream with them.
Uh-huh.
And you have to give them what you want.
Yeah.
What they want, sorry. And that marriage between the two of us of, okay, we're going to rivet, we're going to collar, but guess what? We're not forge welding because they're not paying for 5 hours of work on 3 forge welds instead of 5 hours of work on 4 foot of paneling because we've riveted and welded.
Right.
So yeah, find the marriage between the two. And that's what helped us tremendously throughout the early years.
Okay, so I said two things there. Another thing has come up that I also wanted to ask about, but going to go back to number two that I wanted to ask you about, skill set. Over the last 28 years, what kind of things have you done to increase your skill set? Have you taken any classes? Have you worked with other blacksmiths? What are some of the key elements you would say have brought in you to the skill set you have nowadays?
Well, I was fortunate to serve the apprenticeship back in the UK, and very fortunate to be under the instructions of one Rodney Cranwell, my masterman smith, but also the spooling that I went into, which was Kosyra. Well, first of all, it was the Hereford. Then I went to Salisbury Kosyra College. So I learned from very good blacksmiths. And then I traveled around the UK working for other blacksmiths as well, just soaking in a few things as much as I could on what I was being taught. So my skill set, you know, not blowing my trumpet, but my skill set was quite high when I got to Canada and I started Mystic Forge. But you get those big staircases, it's not all me. I can't do that all on my own. So therefore, in the early days, I had to start teaching guys with a little bit of metalwork background that would come and work for me. So I did that. But then we went to the temporary foreign work permit, which allowed me to bring over journeymen blacksmiths from the UK. We brought over from Hungary. We brought over from Romania. We brought over from Tunisia. These guys that have their journeyman ticket. So they came over, they come in for 2, 3 years, some stayed for five, and some became permanent residents.
Wow,
So
that's awesome.
I would say over the last 15 years, we've had some really highly skilled blacksmiths. Obviously, they come with a skill which is a lot different to what traditional blacksmithing I do from where they're from.
Right.
But because they have that high skill set, they're very adaptable to what I want them to do for Mystic Forge. I found it tough to take a raw Canadian on and teach them and have the time to teach them and also have the budget to teach them.
Interesting. That's a pretty awesome opportunity to have been presented to yourself. I mean, I is that something that almost anybody can kind of tap into, or was that what was it that gave you the ability to tap into that?
Well, the foreign workers.
Yeah.
Well, what it was at the time, I think, because Calgary or Alberta was just booming. We didn't have enough, heartbeats to fill regular labor jobs, let alone skilled jobs. So the Alberta government had a fast track system to bring in skilled workers, and it wasn't obviously just manual trades. It was a lot of doctors, surgeons, nurses, and people like that. So we hooked onto that. My wife, who's in HR, she knows all this stuff anyway.
Yeah.
She hooked into the temporary foreign work permit, which is a 2 years, and then you can extend it to another two.
Nice.
And so yeah, we brought over a blacksmith that worked for Pete and Shona Johnson, or
Oh
Peter Hill from Ratho Forge. So Ratho Forge, they had a really good blacksmith. He was a Hungarian, so he was looking to travel. He's always wanted to come to Canada, so we sponsored him.
What was his name?
And back then, the process was less than 6 weeks to bring him over.
Oh wow, that's
So he
awesome.
was at, you know, he's actually over within 3 weeks.
Wow. What was his name?
His name was Tamas Horvath.
Interesting.
So very skilled, very, very polite, very punctual. He worked for us for 2 years and he had one day off sick.
Oh
yeah
wow. That's
so
a good employee right there.
yeah
What are some of the more notable names that you remember from people that you had come through your shop like that?
Well, not so much working, but we've had some working holiday guys, like Peter and Shona from Ratho. They've come through a few times. They've done some demonstrations in my shop for the local blacksmiths.
Oh, cool.
We have recently we had a guy from England. He went back recently, sorry. He was for us for 5 years.
Oh, wow.
He's now set up his own business in Hereford.
Nice.
So his name is Maxwell Anderson. So he now has a blacksmith shop there.
Very awesome.
And before he got to us, he'd never done any of the big railings really. But his skill set was fantastic. His forging, his sculpture work for us was phenomenal, and we really enjoyed having him. 5 years we had him for, and yeah, it was really good relationship. So he's back and now he's on his own and doing well, really well.
Beautiful. Anything that you can pinpoint that you picked up from him?
Well, he was. We actually went to the same school, but obviously a lot different times. And when we were working together, he would tell me how he was taught at college to do this, and then I remembered how I was taught by obviously different tutors at the time, back in the early 80s, you see, and he was being taught in the early, let's just say mid 2000s, basically.
Okay.
So we had a difference of 30 years there. between us, and it was just the different teaching techniques of what he was taught and what I was taught. It was it was just really interesting. There was a lot of differences.
For sure, for sure. Cool. Okay, so back to that other thing that came up that I said I wanted to come back to eventually. You brought up something very interesting that I just spoke with Brian House about business in the workshop and trying to, you know, how do you make business succeed? And you mentioned that you entertain your clients. Do you want to expand on that a little bit? What do you mean by entertain your clients? You bring them into the shop and you wine and dine them, or you go take them out for dinner?
Yeah,
or...
yeah, so what we do is Mystic Forge is a, you know, like a mom and pop run shop, really. Although we do some of these huge jobs and you think that that comes from some sort of factory, it's not. It's just me and two other guys and my wife, Leah. Leah has been phenomenal over the years. She does obviously all the admin, the books, the accounting and everything that we do. But so if we get a call from one of our architects or one of our builders and they've got a big house and they want to come and bring their clients to the shop, because you can take them to a shop to pick tiles, you can take them to a shop to pick wallpaper, and it's quite, you know, yada, yada, yada. But when they get a chance to come to our blacksmith shop, most of the clients are in oil and gas. As you know, being Alberta, they're building these huge houses, they've had the oil company, everything. So that guy who runs the oil company, he started most probably on ground level. He started with a tool belt, he started with drilling machines, he started with power tools. So he knows what it takes to make something. So what we do is when they come out, you know, we light the forges up. We get the big dies under the big hammers. We have two Massey 300 weights, as well as another air hammer. So we put on a really, you know, a nice, you know, dog and pony show for the client and the architect. The architect and the builder have been here so many times. They're walking around like a big rooster with their chest puffed out. Look at me, I've brought you to this guy and everything. Leah brings over fresh baked scones, fresh pot of coffee, and we all have a bit of a social, you see. And even the guys that work for me will be there, and they get to know the client as well. So if we end up doing the work for them, they know who Duncan is, they know who Hayden is, they know who Joe is, you know. So, you know, then you forge that relationship with them, and they get to know us, and they get to know Leah as well, because Leah will be sending them emails of pictures and designs and prices and quotes and what have you, so they know who it's coming from. And then because it's a small mom-and-pop operation, they're quite happy to support local and to choose local and to keep everything within a radius of where the house is being built. They're not shipping it in and somebody else is putting it together.
Yeah, that's a lovely idea, and I don't think I hear about too many other people doing that kind of putting in that effort. That's a great
idea.
Well,
you got to. So, Lando, if you put away 4 hours for this, so what we would do is we'd light the forge up at 8:30. With me and the guys would mess around and practice what we would be doing for the client. The client turns up at 9:30. They're there for maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. They leave. We have our come down and out. We have lunch. So that 4 hours invested could and should and usually does lead to a six-figure job.
Oh.
Okay, so that six-figure job, all you have to do is do three of them a year, because a six-figure job should only take you and two other guys 6 weeks, 6 to 7 weeks to do.
Based on the machinery that you have in your shop.
Based on what we have, and also based on the way that I have to design it.
Okay.
All right, so... So we would move on with that. So from that stage, we would then make a 5 or 6 foot design sample panel for them. And that's where I would make it from start to finish. And I would turn up on site. I would put it in position in situ for the architect, the clients to look at. There might be some fine tweaking, but most of the time it's, oh my God, wow, I didn't think you could do that. And I love it. Can you do the rest of the 120 feet, please? So, and that's where we start, right? So that 4 hours invested, my 2 days of making that sample panel and the steel cost and the babysitting over that client and architect to the site meeting to finalize the contract. So 2.5 days is worth to get that job that will employ Mystic Forge for 6 to 8 weeks.
How do you go about design aspects? Is that, do you give the client a lot of leeway on what they want for design, or are you mostly guiding that process?
Well, I've, no pun, but I've forged a relationship with the architects and the designers that have been to my shop that actually let me design for what we're capable of doing. Because the blacksmithing side is quite new in Canada compared to Europe, mm-hmm. from what we can do in railings, they've never seen before, or they've only seen in magazines that they always feel is out of their reach.
Right.
So now they have like a Mystic Forge with the power hammers, with the dies and the swages, and with some knowledge behind them, from which I was taught back in the old country, that now they can have that. So they give me free rein to design something. And I'm not going to design something that's going to blow their budget. I'm not going to design something that is going to be me, forge weld this, forge weld that. Oh, you're going to be paying this much per foot. No, it's okay. I've got a feeling what your house is going to be like. I obviously know your budget. So let's, again, like I mentioned previously, let's have a marriage somewhere in between that you get the beautiful railing and we get rewarded for doing all the work. It's quite simple, really.
Where do you think you would be at all of this if you didn't have Leah's guidance or probably guidance, I'm assuming there, right?
Yeah, well, financially, yes. She's actually a financial wizard and she's very clever. She took a break of 12 years from her career, obviously to raise the kids and all that, but raising kids and controlling and working Mystic Forge, that I knew pretty much, not every cent, but I pretty much knew down to every half a day where we were going to be on a big job. So when you price out a job that's going to take 6 to 8 weeks, you're going to be out a day or two. And at the end of the contract, when the last check is in, she would be able to tell me how many days over we were, how many days under we were, where we were on that job. As long as I got her accurate hours, accurate steel costs, accurate overhead for the weld, the gases and everything for welding, and she would work it out because she has a very clever mind when it comes to spreadsheets and computers. That, you know, and we would finish a big job and she would say, okay, so Duncan is due this bonus and Hayden is due that bonus and Joe is due this bonus because we made X amount of money. So that's what we do. So, yeah, she would be, you know, she's, yeah, paramount in running Mystic Forge. Now, I've seen guys that are very talented blacksmiths, but they're also the poorest blacksmiths because they can't control the other end of the shop, which is the office.
Mm-hmm.
And that is huge when it comes to that.
Yeah, well, like Brian House, well, I keep on leaning on Brian House's input so much to what I do and what we as blacksmiths do, but 50% of the work is making what we do and the other 50% of it is selling what we do, right? And part of that is selling it is controlling your finances to a finite understanding. You know, I hate accounting. I can't stand it. I took computer programming in college when I first moved to Winnipeg. That's why I moved to Winnipeg. It's why I went to college. Realize I can't stand accounting, didn't realize that the course was attached to accounting for computer programming. Well, lo and behold, that's all that the course was about, was priming you to be a computer programmer for accounting programs. No thank you. I dropped out after the first semester and I didn't know what to do with myself. So I eventually got into metalworking. But I look back on that now and it's like, man, maybe accounting is something I really should take a little bit more serious and come to understand a bit better, eh?
Yeah, I totally agree. It's the, what you need to, as the wouldn't say the owner of the business, but as the kingpin of the business, which I am, as a blacksmith. So you're a blacksmith in your business. You are the kingpin, right?
Right.
You need to understand where your money goes. You need to understand how you earn your money. And you need to understand how you spend your money from what you earn from that job. So over the years, we would always calculate, okay, our profit margin is this. And guess what? We need a rolling machine, and that rolling machine is this. Okay, so we need to do something else to buy that rolling machine, or we just go out and buy it because we made that profit margin. So over the years, that's what we've done. Hence, we don't. The only thing we farm out now is powder coating.
Oh yeah,
and galvanizing.
Would you ever?
So all our.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, Landon. All our rolling, all our bending, all our plasma cutting. We obviously don't have a laser, but all of that stuff is done in-house. So in the early years, we were sending out for people to roll, and we'd be paying them a lot of money to roll the product. We would be sending out steel to be plasma cut. We would be sending out for... stuff to be bent, brake pressed and stuff like that. But all that is done in-house now. So over the years, we've learned where to spend our money compared to, oh, I made this much money. All right?
Now, see, there's an interesting concept to that because I was just listening to, I backtracked on some Blacksmith or Radio podcast with Victoria Patty, and she had the gentleman from Albert Paley's shop on her show. And I was listening to that episode. I apologize, I can't remember the man's name right now. But he went into talking about how they only do specific things in-house. Welding, assembly essentially, the high-end assembly of very large pieces. And they outsource, you know, like 30-foot sheets, 30-foot by 10-foot sheets to be rolled or bent or whatever by another company because in their mind... let those people that are good at doing what they're good at doing, let them do it and let us focus on what we're good at doing and we'll do that. And for Albert Paley, the main thing that he's good at is designing crazy sculpture, right? Versus having all these break machines. But in my mind, I'm like, well, you're losing out. Like, it's not that hard to run a break machine or a rolling machine as long as you've got the space for it. You're out in the rural area of south of Calgary, right?
I'm northwest of Calgary, between Calgary and Banff.
Oh no! Oh, dude! Wow! You see the mountains from your shop? I can't remember.
Yep.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Oh man.
Yeah, we got a very beautiful view.
I'm jealous.
But coming back on that, sourcing your workout for other companies, there, Lando. So, obviously, Albert Paley was Big Fry, right? He's rolling those big sheet machines, those big sheets. So, you might need a specified machine. But if you take it, if somebody comes and knocks on your door and says, okay, I need you to make me this railing, and you worked it out that if you're charging $50,000 for this railing, your profit margin wants to be $20,000 on that job, okay? So, out of $30,000 cost, you could do that and make your $20,000 profit. Now, if you had to farm your workout, what happens to your profit margin?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It shrinks, right?
Totally. Yeah. That's exactly how I look at it, man. Yeah. And like I said, if you've got this space to have that equipment and the ability to run it, I mean, okay, so you have to hire somebody. But again, it's all about your profit margin. Does it make more sense to hire that person? And I guess a lot of it comes down to, for you, for example, you know you're building railings and the same machine can be utilized over and over again. Some of those machines being your big power hammers. And this is a question that I really wanted to get into. What are some of the other key machines that you really lean on? You said a rolling machine. How big is this rolling machine that you lean on?
So we have the two roller machines. One is a pyramid roller. So that pyramid roller will roll 3 inch by 3/4 flat bar on the hard way.
Wow.
Anything up to that. And then we have a plate roller that will roll 4x8 quarter-inch plate sheets.
Oh.
So we roll that to the radius of the plan radius of a staircase.
Yeah.
And that's what we build our staircases around. So we call that a mantle, that. Right?
Yeah, we've talked about this on the other episode.
Yeah, so another thing, so when the guys first start out blacksmithing, they've got their forge, they've got their anvil, and they make the bottle openers to make the fire pokers. What do you do after you finish your product? You go and wire wheel it, right?
Right.
You stand at a pedestal and you wire wheel it, or you've got a hand grinder and you wire wheel it. But then somebody came up with the idea and they made a tumbler.
Mm-hmm.
So you obviously know what a tumbler is, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So now you make your 10 bottle openers, you stick it in the tumbler for half an hour whilst you go and do something else.
Yep.
So you've invested in a machine to build a tumbler that in half an hour has 10 bottle openers instead of you standing at the pedestal wire wheel for maybe half an hour, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So how much did you pay that tumbler to tumble those pieces? Zero. $5 for electric.
For electric, that. Right, yep.
So you've invested in a machine to either buy or build that down the road. Our tumbler still works for us. And we made our tumbler over 25 years ago.
Yes! This is what I'm talking about. They're
bulletproof, right?
Yep.
So that it still works for us. Same with our plasma cutter table. It's the same with our rolling machines. They still work for us. They pay for themselves. And now I'm not paying a company $120 an hour for their apprentice to roll it through.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paying my guy his hourly rate, and he's learning. And also, we get it done there and then.
Yeah.
So as we work through a job, okay, we realize that we've got this handrail to roll. We can roll it that afternoon, whereas if I have to go to a company, you know, I'm held by the short and curlies for days.
Yeah,
right?
Could be weeks, could be months even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the biggest problem with a lot of businesses, and it was a problem with us in the early days, was cash flow.
Mm.
Cash flow is huge for small guys like us.
Yeah.
Because obviously you get a deposit through on a big job, that gets eaten up with steel, that gets eaten up with overhead, and that gets eaten up with other bills from previous jobs. And then before you know it, you're 3 days into the job and the deposit has been eaten up. So now you're chasing your tail that you have to get it done in 2 weeks to get that paycheck in. But the problem is you get the dirt job done, you put the invoice in, and then you know it's a 30-day pay period. So the cash flow really starts to buy into the small guys. And it did for us for so long. We had to figure out a way around biting into other people's deposits whilst we were still working on other jobs.
Yeah.
And this is obviously where Leah came in on purchasing stuff and how we purchase it.
Have you ever been, have you ever had to deal with a customer stiffing you?
What do you say that? I had this conversation with a builder a couple of weeks ago, just before I came out west here on holiday. This builder I'm doing work for now, he was one of my first ever clients back in 1995. We did a job with him. He was the project manager on site for a big company. And so I got to know him really well. He's obviously thrived and gone on his own now, but we did a job in 95. And it wasn't a big job. I think it was about a $15,000 railing. Stupid me, didn't take a deposit. The job was installed. The client was there when I installed the job. She absolutely loved it. Thank you very much. I invoiced the builder. So I got in touch with this project manager who became friends with the site. And I asked him where the guy, his name, let's call him Dave. I asked, where does Dave live? So he told me Dave's address, and I went round there and knocked on his door. And this was back in the day when I was still playing football.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some size to me and some intimidation. And it's funny how that happened, because he wrote me a check there and then. And that's the only time I've been stiff.
Oh, wow.
Every other time we've got our deposit, we've got progress payments, and we've been paid on time. No problem.
And you mentioned contracts a few times. That's something that's extremely important when you're dealing with large scale, especially six-figure jobs. I mean, even if it was a five-figure job, you're going to want to have a contract for something like that, right?
Absolutely. With that contract, you've protected yourself, you've protected your staff in your shop, I've protected my business, but also the client has protected themselves. Because if we don't do a job that's up to their standard, or if we don't do a job the same as the sample, then they've got a call back to us. And we, you know, we put our hands up and say, you know what, we didn't do a great job, or, well, that's never happened, but we didn't copy the sample, that's never happened. So they've got to come back as well. It's not just all about us. Halfway through the job, if we're installing and they don't like something because now they've changed their mind, then we change it. But it's obviously it's at a cost.
Yeah.
You know?
Built into the contract, so of course, right?
So we get to tweak the cost.
At what scale do you believe it becomes important to start attaching a contract to your work?
I would say it would different between me and you, because I have three guys and myself and Leah. Mm-hmm. So there's five of us employed. And we have a part-timer as well. So let's say six people employed. So my threshold of a contract would be different to someone like yourself that's just only you, right, in your shop.
Right.
Is that correct? That's correct, right?
Yeah. Now, I'm not even a business at this point. I'm just a hobbyist now, so.
Okay, so.
I'm kind of digging in context of not just myself, but other makers that might be looking at this at having to attach a contract to their work, right?
Yes. Okay. So I would say anything. So if you're a one-man shop or one and another guy, anything of $5,000 and over, start getting into contracts. Obviously, if it's a site job, have a look at the site. Then realize, you know what, I should draw up a contract here because they want me on a bucket lift or they want me on scaffolding. So I should write in a contract that will take care of all this. Not just the cost of the apparatus, but also the cost of what happens if something happens, you know? So we did a job previously, well, just at the end of June. We put a chimney cap on a house and they lifted us up in a bucket. And it was me and my young son. He just graduated from high school. He started an apprenticeship at the moment as a millwright, but in between school and millwrighting, I took him on site. So we've never been up in a bucket before that high. And we've never had to wear the harness or the fall arrest. We had no clue how to wear it, how to put it on.
I'm surprised both of you in the bucket at the same time. Like, isn't there like a weight restriction? Like, both of you guys are like, you guys are like 6'6". Yeah. So you tell like 300-pound dudes, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so we're up there and we've got the fall arrest on and we have to climb out onto the chimney cap and then we have to disconnect and rope ourselves off to the chimney cap because they have to lift the bucket down and put the metalwork in there and lift it onto us. So yeah, it was quite, you know, so we didn't have a contract for that because they were taking care of everything. We didn't have to hire the fall arrest. We didn't have to hire the bucket or anything, but those guys supplied it. And they gave us a 10-second tutorial on how to wear a harness, and that was it.
Yeah, beautiful.
got it done.
So do you find with your work that you're constantly having to add more and more tooling to your shop, or do you feel like you've kind of gotten to a point now where adding your tooling is, you've added the tooling you needed, but every once in a while there's still the occasional piece?
I would agree with you, Lando. There is an occasional piece, but it's not a high price ticket like it used to be. We have the lathe, we have a milling machine, we have everything. I think anything that's costing over $2,000 or $3,000, we have that all. We might go and do a job where we need a little widget or something for a job, and we'll just go out and buy that to make the job go smoother or get a better quality product at the end of the day. But I would say maybe 10 years ago, we stopped buying the bigger machinery to do the work because we had everything. Most of the times, I will design around the machinery and the skill wheel we have in the shop. Last 3 or 4 years, I've designed it mainly around the guys I have in my shop, not me, because I work from 10 till 4. I have other interests as well. Now I'm pushing on the wrong side of 50. I like to do other stuff. So when a designer comes with a client for a railing, we'll sit down and we'll talk about the design and everything. We'll show how we do stuff. And then I will direct that into the skill we have in the shop without me, basically.
And one of these other hobbies that you've managed to pick up in your later years is flexing for MILFs on the beach. You were telling me earlier.
I do that, but then the alarm goes off and I wake up and I'm thinking, oh right, I'm the wrong age now. I'm no football player anymore, so I've got to. So yeah, I got two big teenagers to take care of, so I got to guide them in the right way of life.
Yeah, they're the ones flexing for MILFs now, right?
Well, they're both, believe it or not, Lando, I'm touching 6, 6.5.
Mm-hmm.
They're both taller than me, and they're 16 and 17 years old.
I know, they're huge boys, man. I'd be proud of them if I were you, that's for sure. Yeah. I see all the accomplishes. Yeah, you post about them all the time.
Well, my oldest one, Odin, he just graduated from high school. He had a tough high school. He was just traumatized at school. He had reading difficulties, writing difficulties and everything. But he was a mechanical savant. He could fix anything. He's up until he was 16, he's renovated 3 snowmobiles, 1 dirt bike, and he's done the mechanics on my workshop. Like, I let him on my hammers. Nice. I let him fix the pistons on my air hammers. That's how good he is. Because he can figure out how it works. Blacksmithing wasn't his passion. He wants to be a fixer and a builder. So through my contacts, he's now apprenticing for most probably the smartest machine shop in Calgary.
That's so awesome, dude. Congrats.
Yeah, so that's really good.
Cool, man. What a couple baseline questions that we go through usually nowadays on our podcast. Oh, you know what? I just realized I didn't bring up Song of the Week with Brian House when I chatted with him. What have you been listening to lately? What's hot on your music list?
Well, sorry to say, I am stuck in the 80s.
That's awesome.
And I have my so at the moment I'm out at the lake property here. We have some property on the Okanagan.
Yeah.
And I'm out here for a month. Leah joins me for 2 or 3 weeks. Usually the boys come out with me. We do the fishing thing and the wakeboard and stuff and everything. But both those guys are back in Calgary earning money and living together in a basement suite in Calgary. So.
Oh, cool.
So it's just me. So I take my tunes down to the lake, and it is the retro, the 80s, the new wave music I grew up with. I listen to a bit of country in the at the barbecue pit here, and I like a bit of the country music as well. Stuck in the 80s.
What's one of the key songs that you'll lean on, bud?
Iran, Flock of Seagulls.
Nice. Beautiful. That's awesome, dude.
Yeah. Iran, Flock of Seagulls. Any Duran Duran song?
Oh, God, buddy.
This is embarrassing.
No, that's awesome, dude. I love it.
There's a thing on
YouTube that I listen to a lot that is the radio station from Grand Theft Auto video game, and one of the radio stations was an 80s radio station, and the DJ for it is this chick that's like super hyped up, probably most likely on coke the whole time, right? And all the songs are just brilliant 80s songs. I absolutely love the playlist for it.
Yeah, I like that. I got into a little bit of the rock as well back in England. I like Genesis and Pink Floyd.
Nice.
So sometimes I'll put them on if I'm in the mood. We listen. I let the guys at work have their earbuds in, so they can listen to their stuff. One guy doesn't listen to music, he just listens to podcasts. So now he can listen to yours.
I was going to say, I hope you're promoting that they should listen to Forge Side Chat while they're working. I mean, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Learn while you work, right?
Yeah. No, I wear my Canine COVID t-shirt around the shop every now and then.
Awesome. That's awesome.
We've got that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on that event. That was 2 hours with you, dude. That was an excellent chat.
That was good. I really enjoyed that.
Are you working with Maritime Knife Supply at all?
No.
Dude, you need to check out maritimeknifesupply.com or .ca. Maritime Knife Supply is run by Lawrence Lake. It's a knife supply company out of Nova Scotia, but he also supplies a lot of blacksmithing supplies. Awesome dude. Ships all across North America really quick. If you're looking for a Paragon or an Even Heat kiln, you can use the code FSCKILN on checkout and save yourself $100 on kilns. And we're also lined up with a company out of Saskatchewan, the Tuller Linseed. Dude, best linseed oil you'll ever get your hands on. He's got a couple other products where he puts in beeswax or canuba wax in with the linseed oil. Great finishing product. That's thetullerlinseed.com. And you can save 10% on orders, $50 or more, using the code FORGECHAT10 with them. Awesome. Dawson's an amazing dude. Him and his brother farm that stuff right in Saskatchewan, press the seed there, and jar it themselves. So it's homegrown, homemade, awesome stuff. No additives, so it's food safe.
Noted.
We were talking about music. I'm a little bit different than you, but not because I love the 80s stuff, but I haven't been listening to that. I've been listening to Offspring lately, Ixnay on the Ombre, and the specific song I go to is Don't Pick It Up. One of my favorite, it's kind of got the two-tone.
So how many songs can you name with the word blacksmith in? The only one I know is sung by a Canadian group.
Oh, really? Okay, who's that?
Rush.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. What? But is Blacksmith in the title of the song?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the name of the song?
Blacksmith Forges It Up.
Okay. I'm not a huge Rush fan, so my apologies. I know that they talk about the blacksmith in their song, but yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think there's a singing group kind of thing that uses anvil sounds in their music that might be based out of Canada as well, but I don't quote me on that one. What's your...
Yeah, the Calgary...
No, go ahead. The Calgary...
The Calgary Philharmonic Orchestra, they actually rented 3 or 4 of my anvils for a concert.
That's awesome, dude. Super awesome.
And a couple of hammers, and they found out the tune of the hammers on the anvil, and they incorporated that into one of their symphonies.
And it's perfect that you bring that up. You walk me right into the question I wanted to ask you. What are your anvils that you use? What's your go-to anvil? What's the one that you like to use the most, specifically?
I have a Peter Wright. It's only a 250-pound. I use that mainly for myself. The one that gets used mostly in a shop is a Rat Hole by Steve Fontanani.
Right.
Use his. That's a 440-pound anvil.
Woo!
And then we have about 3 or 4 French anvils with double horns that are around about 320 pounds.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Like it.
And what's your go-to hammer? What's the hammer you like to go to?
Well, the actual hammer I like the most is, I was actually talking to him this morning, is a blacksmith in Minnesota. His name is Nathan Robinson from Jack Pine Forge.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
He makes pretty much the best hammer out there for your money.
Really?
But a really good hammer.
Cool.
And I've been using these for over 20 years here in Canada. It's a cross beam. It's 45 cross beam. But I think I've got about 15 of his hammers in my shop.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, they're that good. Yeah.
Cool. Dude, I've got so much more I want to talk to you about, and I know your timeline is kind of tight, and so is mine. Unfortunately, I've got family in
Well,
town.
I'm on holiday, so I start drinking in 2 hours, so I'm no problem.
Well, I actually have some family in town, and I think if I'm not mistaken, I'm supposed to go meet them for dinner in about an hour, and where I'm meeting them for dinner is about a 40-minute drive from here, so I'll have to wrap it up right away.
No problem.
Now, what's. Oh, if you could work with any blacksmith for a day, maybe a little bit longer, I don't know, dead or alive, you can pick any blacksmith. Who would it be?
Tommy Tucker.
Tommy Tucker, who's that?
Tommy Tucker. So Tommy Tucker was a blacksmith back in England. He was the guy that graded and marked our coursework at Kosyra in Salisbury. He was given the key to the city of London
Huh.
for his work. For his work he did in London.
That's pretty cool.
So Tommy Tucker would be the guy. And I got a picture of me and him when he presented me with my certificate with the blacksmithing college I was at.
Cool. That's awesome, dude.
Yep.
Cool. So, the boys are moving on in life. They're not going to stay working with you in the shop.
Nope, that's fine with me. A lot of guys will toss me, oh, Odin's going to take over Mystic Forge now, but you know what? That's not his passion. And I've seen a lot of father and son's relationships go south when corner because Odin is so gifted at his passion. Why would I deny that?
Totally, 100%,
And
man.
it's
I
just that guy saying, my guys are 6'6", 6'7". Oh, they're going to play football, right? Like you did. No. One of them likes football, but that's not his goal. The other one is great at rugby, and that's what he wants to do in his part time. So yeah, you just gotta let him go where they want to go. My dad did it to me. My dad let me go where I wanted to go. Well,
Yeah.
he actually forced me to go because he didn't want me to be a turkey tosser for the rest of my life.
Well, he helped give you some guidance in an area where maybe it was kind of needed, right? I think with your kids, they've grown up kind of been giving that guidance all along to don't go and masturbate turkeys for the rest of your life, right?
Yeah. And the funny thing is because I grew up on a somewhat of a farm where we used to, kill and butcher the stuff we used to eat, I still do that at my house, my acreage.
That's awesome, man.
We have a steer for the freezer. We have turkeys, lamb and stuff like that we butcher ourselves.
Nice.
So they know where the food's coming from and they understand that, right?
So
So
you
my
farm your
guys, every Christmas they're out there, they do. Go ahead, Lana.
You far these are this is all cattle of your own then?
Well, I wouldn't say cattle, it's a cow.
Yeah,
So we just
well.
have the one every year that we put in our own freezer.
Okay. But
Right? And then
you buy
we
the
have a
cow from
half
somebody
dozen
else. You
turkeys we
don't
kill for Christmas.
you don't raise the cow yourself.
Yeah,
Okay.
we buy it at around about it's a steer, so it's a year old. It comes in and we fat it up for a year and
Nice.
then take it from there ourselves.
Cool. Very cool. That's awesome. And do you hunt as well?
No, never got into hunting, never had the time to do it.
Okay. Have you ever made a knife? And do you make knives?
I'm not very good at making knives. I don't thoroughly enjoy making knives, but I have made several for friends.
Okay.
And I have made several for our property out here in the Okanagan as
Yeah.
well for certain things.
You have a two
So,
by 72 in your shop then?
sorry, Lando?
Do you have a 2x72 grinder in your shop, or what kind of grinding station do you have?
No, we in the shop we have a regular belt sander. but it's not that great. And then the rest I go on with, if I'm making one for a friend, I will go to a friend, my other friend's shop, who has a knife grinder, a belt
Okay.
grinder for that.
Gotcha.
But if I'm making one just for the farm or for the acreage here, we'll just smash it out and we'll just do it on the angle grinders.
Right. Right angle group.
Yeah.
A right angle grinder community.
Yeah. So actually, now we finish it off with a. Are you familiar with a deburring wheel?
Not necessarily, I'm not sure, no.
And we put a deburring wheel on a Widowmaker, which is our 12-inch pedestal grinder. So the deburring wheel, we put that guy on there, and that brings up a phenomenal finish. Absolutely unbelievable. Even I've shown it to other guys that make knives and says, "How did you get that finish on there?" I said, "You know, it's with a 3M deburring wheel. It's phenomenal what it does to steel."
What's a deburring wheel look
Yeah.
like?
It's like a big compressed composite with bits of diamond and glass and stuff in it. And when it's on a 12-inch pedestal grinder, you can it just polishes up that thing like you wouldn't believe. I'm not into Damascus. I don't do the Damascus thing. I just take, is it W1 or 4140 or stuff like that. I forge out the rough shape and then I just take to a grinder. Yeah, I'm not into the Damascus stuff. That my oldest boy is into Damascus. He does a lot of forge welding for his stuff. He makes blades with his friends.
Ever thought about trying to incorporate Damascus into your artwork?
We have several times, only by request. I've never pushed it, but we had a really, really clever client. He's an engineer. Actually, he's the first guy in Alberta to get oil out the ground with negative carbon.
Oh.
So he's invented a system that you pump oil out the ground using CO2 and it comes out negative carbon somehow. And he took this idea, this pattern that he had, he took it to Alberta government, he took it to the Canadian government, and they all told him to get lost. Now he is a multi billionaire because America bought his patent.
Nice. That's awesome.
You believe that?
That's so awesome, dude.
So anyway, he wanted a job. He wanted a job with his initials in, and he wanted to incorporate. He started off life as a apprentice carpenter, so he wanted his tools incorporated in a piece of furniture. So we put our heads together, thinking of stuff, and he says, "Can we put a wrench here? Can we put this plane blade here?" I says, "You know what? Why don't we weld it all together in the forge? Let's forge weld it. Let's laminate it, and let's acid dip it and bring it out as Damascus in your initials on your furniture." So we
No.
did that. We welded everything together and we forged out his initials. We polished the hell out of it and we put it in the acid and the coffee and everything, and it just came out just beautiful.
Oh, I love it,
And he
buddy.
was so chill. And it's one of a kind, right? it's
Totally.
um, it's a piece of furniture that when you walk in his house, it's the first thing you see, his initials on a forged piece of furniture. So yeah, that was pretty cool.
Brilliant. Just brilliant, dude. I love it.
Yeah,
Cool.
and then we was in a out to the Okanagan here. There's a blacksmith called Patrick MacGyver
Oh, yeah.
who owns Dancing Scott Forge, and for 3 or 4 years in a row, he had put on a forging competition here called Sound of the Forge.
Oh, really?
And me and my son used to go in that. Obviously, my son was younger. We used to go in this. And 1 year we did a Damascus feather on a dream catcher. So we
Nice.
forged a dream catcher, we forged the Damascus feather and everything, and yeah.
That's awesome too, dude. Oh, I love it. I've thought so much about how to incorporate Damascus into artwork, and there's so many different ways you can do it, and those are some brilliant ideas for sure, man.
Yeah, and the feather was actually amazing because the pattern in the feather was really it married really well with the pattern of the veins of the leaf and of the feather as well. Feather, so
for sure,
it came out really good. Yeah,
you do feather pattern Damascus and make a feather out of it.
Yeah, there is that as well, right? You can do the feather pattern, which we didn't do at the time. We just, you know, it was a competition, so I think we only had 2 hours to do our piece.
Wow.
So, because we had to make the dream catcher in the bracket as well, so.
Crazy. Cool. Okay, dude, well, I got to wrap it up and get ready to meet up with my family for dinner here. I'm really sorry that we didn't get more time to chat, kind of my fault for screwing up scheduling here with us, but I really appreciate you giving me the time to sit down.
Have a great supper with your family.
Thanks, buddy. And I hope
have a great supper with your family. Don't eat too much.
Oh, for sure. Hope you enjoy the rest of your summer and your time in the Okanagan, my man.
Will do.
Awesome.
Yeah, do some fishing, some boarding, pretend I'm a lot younger than I am.
If you don't mind, try to copy what I do here for the closeout, okay? You ready for this?
What's that? Yeah.
Coo-roo-coo-coo-coo-coo-coo-coo-coo. You did it, man. That's awesome. You're in.
Om shakalaka. See you, Lando.
Cheers, my man. Okay, guys. Thanks a lot for listening. That was episode 99. Mark Pierce. Think we're going to have to sit down with Mark again because that was short-winded. I ended up having to kind of book out of here real quick to go have some dinner with some family that's in from out of town. I really want to sit down with Mark. If you haven't listened to the Canarn episode we had with Mark, you can head over to canarn.ca, use the password Big Anvils. There's a capital B, capital A, and that'll give you access to the virtual Canarn edition. There's a 2-hour chat with Mark Pierce. Again, we probably went over some of the same stuff. I'm probably going to end up going over it again when I sit down with him again. But there's also a completely different aspect that I'm taking on the podcast that you may have noticed lately. We're really honing in on business in the workplace, like Brian House likes to talk about. And I got a surprise for you that might be coming up soon. So sit back and relax.